Hey, it's Zach. The Low Post is brought to you by Goodyear, celebrating March deal days with month-long service and savings. Visit GoodyearAutoservice.com for offers. I wanted to tell you about a new podcast called Daily Wager, which has all the information you need on tonight's games. Listen every weekday afternoon. That's every afternoon for the latest info on the biggest games and plays. That's Daily Wager. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on a Monday afternoon in the Northeast. And we are 10 days away from the trade deadline. There's much to talk about in the league, and one of our best writers just framed all of this in a very interesting way, and I wanted to bring him on to talk about that. The one and only guru of maps, former San Antonio Spurs executive, Mr. Kurt Goldsberry. How are you?
I am great, Zach, and it's good to see your face. We're almost through this thing now, and by the thing, I mean, of course, the trade deadline period.
Yes, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. So you wrote a great piece today that touches on stuff I've written about before, but it's very interesting. And the piece you wrote is basically there's been so much player movement at the top of the league, superstars changing teams more than ever before by trade, by free agency, by trades that are the choice of the team, not always dictated by the player. There's been a lot of movement, we know that, but you highlighted a result of that movement that has been perhaps a little bit underplayed. Can you explain to people what that is?
Yeah, thanks. And we've all written a piece like this, I think, if you cover the NBA in the last 3 or 4 years. So this is just my swing at it. You did a great piece in 2018. I encourage the listeners, I think it was 2018, maybe 19. I don't even know anymore. But anyway, my angle, Zach, is the plight of the small market, NBA team. I give a lot of focus to on this and these elite superstar free agent migrations or trade migrations are sort of revealing to me that there are two NBAs emerging. One, if you are a destination market like a Los Angeles or a New York, and one, if you're not, like if you're a Memphis or you're Orlando, what kind of market you're in, Zach, I think is starting to really determine how you build your team. If you're fortunate enough to be in Brooklyn or New York or Los Angeles, you have access to this elite level transaction. And if you're not, you don't, and you better slow cook your competitor through the draft and team. Player development becomes your most important team building tool.
So what spurred you to write this now?
You know, I think the Harden trade, honestly, I think it was always kind of there. Obviously, I spent years in San Antonio seeing the world through the lens of a very successful small market team.
Until you got there.
Until I got there. Fair enough. But I think I was once Harden and freaking Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving got on the same team. I think I was sort of just like, you know, this is kind of happening. But for me personally, James Harden reuniting with Kevin Durant in their absolute primes after separating and both winning MVPs, both winning scoring titles. Come on, man. That's what spurred me on, I think.
So Brooklyn and the Clippers are interesting examples of this that sort of rose in parallel, right? And so they struck these landmark transactions. One, and in the same summer, they started in the same summer, Brooklyn getting Durant and Irving via free agency / sign and trade, whatever you want to call how they got Durant. And the Clippers making the just mega deal for Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. One a free agent, one a trade that was sort of connected to Kawhi's free agency. It's almost like they traded for two players at once. Oklahoma City now has 49 draft picks, I think. I'm just making that up, but just a lot of draft picks. And they own Miami, they own the Clippers, they own the Rockets to some extent. They just own everyone's draft picks. And then of course Brooklyn, that put Brooklyn and the Clippers again together in a fascinating spot, which is, do we want a big two or do we want to really throw all the chips we've got left to get a third star? And Brooklyn had a lot of chips left, as we saw, because they threw them all to get James Harden. And so they got James Harden. They answered that question by saying, we like our depth. Our depth is nice, blah, blah, blah. We think we can rebuild some of that depth via buyouts, as we've already seen, and other things, and we can keep enough of it around, and that these three guys are so good that we don't need all that quality depth. Boom, James Harden comes to Brooklyn. So A person wanting to argue against the notion that players are flocking to the glamour markets. Okay, let me just parrot that person to you and you can respond. Brooklyn and the Clippers. Well, no one was going there to either of those teams until both of them at the same time laid a foundation of competency. And that's the Brooklyn, Kenny Atkinson, D'Angelo Russell, Joe Harris, Jared Allen, blah, 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 Dinwiddie, etc. Frisky team gets in the playoffs, gets spanked, but got in the playoffs. Clippers is the Lou Williams, Pat Beverly, Montrezl Harrell, Danilo Gallinari, etc., Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, etc. Gets in the playoffs, gives the Warriors, a spirited six-game first-round series. Not until you lay that groundwork are any superstars going to those places. So it's not about the coast or the locations or anything like that. It's about the quality of the franchise. Tripling down on that, Mr. Goldsberry, this person would say, who have the Knicks gotten? The Knicks are in the biggest market in the country, one of the glitziest markets in the world. They've been poo-poo since Carmelo Anthony was there. Nobody will take their money. Nobody wants to go there. Please defend yourself against this person.
Great point. I want to say two things.
It's not that great of a point. That's my point in making the point. The meta point is I don't think it's that great of a point.
Terrible point. So here's what I'd say. And one of the bright young executives in one of these really well-run small market teams, not San Antonio, gave me this line, and I'm going to use it to counter this straw man argument. Being in a glamour market like New York or Los Angeles is necessary, but not sufficient to becoming a super team destination.
Boy, that's a quotable. Put that on the back of a cocktail napkin. What nerd told you this?
Hey, I can't reveal my sources, as you know, in the business here. But I think it's a great point because I think it tells you, you know, the Clippers were in LA, as you point out, and couldn't get this done. Steve Ballmer buys the team. They have a very big cultural makeover. And to that organization's credit, they put themselves in a position. The same with my good friend Sean Marks in Brooklyn, who I used to work with in San Antonio. When he left San Antonio, he left one market where you really can't build a team through big time glamour free agency, let's be honest. And he moved to one where you can't. That said, the Nets were not in great shape when he was hired there. He took a risk with his career, and he deserves immense amount of credit for putting them in this position. To get that Caris LeVert player to get into the Harden position. As you said, they were really well-run teams. They happened to be in glamour organizations. The question I would ask about Sean, and I do in the piece, is like, could he have done this exact same thing in Charlotte or Minneapolis? And I don't think he could have. I think the market does a lot of the work in this story. I think if you're in Los Angeles, it's kind of easier to build a championship team in Los Angeles than it is in Memphis or Orlando. That's sort of what my response in a nutshell would be.
Yeah, and this is what I've written before. The photo negative of this never happens. Two players right. Do not conspire to go to Milwaukee. Two of the top 10 players in the league don't get together and say, we're going to Milwaukee, we're going to Indiana, we're going to Oklahoma City, we're going to Memphis. It does not happen. If you are in one of those markets, you do not have access to that kind of mega transaction. So yes, Brooklyn and LA deserve a ton of credit for building platforms that players will look at and say, that's a franchise that knows what it's doing. I want to go there. It doesn't matter if the Grizzlies do that. The Grizzlies need to draft Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr. And kudos to them. They did. They now have something going. And that to me is the ultimate proof that, yes, this is an unavoidable thing. The photo negative does not happen. It only happens in the biggest markets or the best markets. Or when you have the Golden State's a really interesting example, right? Because they're another market that was never thought of in these terms before. Then they have an incredible series of draft picks. They build a dynastic team. And only then does the power of their market plus the power of their roster combine to get you Kevin Durant and ruin the NBA. Now, I'm just being facetious, but, you know, for 2 years, sort of take the championship out of circulation.
Yeah, I think you've said it very well. You've written about this well. I think these migratory paths of the best are sort of one-way streets. I think that's how I would describe it. You can start in Memphis and go to Los Angeles, but it's very rare for somebody like, let's say, Kobe Bryant or Steph Curry, who gets drafted and, you know, develops into an all-time player to go to one of these small markets. You could almost see Steph doing it, going home to Charlotte at the end of his career or something. But the idea that the photo negative never happens is one of the main pieces here. And that's why I argue, like, what happens to Oklahoma City or Indiana when they lose a Paul George, or what happens to San Antonio when they lose a Kawhi Leonard, or New Orleans when they lose an Anthony Davis, the stakes are so high. They have to go back to the seed phase of the agriculture and start growing their food again and hope that in 5 years, the Zion Williamson is ready to be a championship level.
We're going to talk about Zion.
You know what I'm saying? But that's why the stakes are so high. The other side of the coin is that these guys who don't grow their own food just go to the drive-thru and just pick up whatever they want in the offseason or every other offseason when they're players in major free agency.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish, but you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
The Low Post fans, listen up. Have you heard you can listen to episodes of this very show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership? That's right. All your favorite The Low Post episodes can be heard on Amazon Music ad-free. But that's not all. You can listen to other top podcasts like First Take and Pardon the Interruption ad-free as well. They also have favorite shows like The Daily, Part of My Take, and Up First, all without ads. You know what this means? Uninterrupted listening, so no more cliffhangers. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts, so we know they definitely have something for you. And it's already included in your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/low. That's amazon.com/low to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As you say in your story over and over again, and I've said over and over again, players asking for trades is not the NBA's balance of power being tilted out of whack. Oh, the players are running amok. No, no, no. Teams can trade players whenever they want. And in fact, some teams have gotten off superstar players, not because those players demanded out, but because those teams decided these players are not worth the contracts that they are going to demand and get in the open market. Jimmy Butler in Chicago, I think, is the preeminent example of the last half decade, a fork in the road moment for the Bulls that they decided, we don't want Jimmy Butler on our team. They're not a coastal market, and they got out of the business of Jimmy Butler voluntarily, and they're still wandering in the wilderness today. And so I do think, for superstar players who have no control over where they play for the first minimum 7 years of their career, to me, this is just tilting the balance of power to an equilibrium with teams and owners. That said, this is a 30-team enterprise in, 28 cities? Okay? The enterprise ceases to exist if half of those cities cannot compete for championships. Now, I don't think that's the case, and the NBA would correctly point out the team you just worked for has won 5 championships. The Thunder had 3 superstar players and a hell of a chance to win championships. Other small market teams before have won championships or competed for championships. Milwaukee is in the hunt now. And, of course, they would also parrot the argument that I parroted before. But I do think this bifurcation that you're talking about is somewhat real and has consequences beyond just can you win the championship or not. And I'm going to read you one line for your story that I think is the most important line in your story, and I want you to explain it. Here's the line. Draft picks have never been more meaningful in origin markets and never meant less in the destination markets. As a result, the precious few teams that can reliably retain top talent are emptying their cupboards to extract unhappy superstars and mega trades. In other words, if I'm Brooklyn, I don't care about draft picks. If I'm Oklahoma City, I need all the draft picks because I've realized that's the only way I can build a championship team. What that line to me encapsulates everything that's in your piece. Can you explain a little bit more about what you're getting at there?
Yeah, that's really what set me off. And one of my friends who's an executive in the league really summed it up for me. He's like, there's 3 classic team building tools in the NBA, the draft, free agency, and trades. And it's really starting to feel like, depending on the nature of your market, you really only have access to one, two, or three of those legs. You know, the Clippers and the Lakers, they can get free agents and mega trades almost anytime they want. But the Spurs, the Magic, you know, the Hornets, the draft is really their lifeblood. And draft picks are their seeds. And it seems like that is always been true to some degree, but the draft really is increasingly important in those small markets that have to grow their own food, and decreasingly important in the era of free agency. And one of the stats I got when I researched this piece really hit this home for me. Between 1969 and 2010, only 7 of 41 finals MVPs, Zach, won the award after changing teams. Then LeBron James in 2010 took his talents to South Beach. I'm not mad at him. Great decision for him in his career. It set the tone for a new era of superstar free agency. Suddenly, since then, 8 of the past 10 finals MVPs have won the award after changing teams. That is, to me, one of the league's most important awards, the most symbolic award, and it used to be exceedingly rare for that to go to somebody who had changed teams. Now, championships are won and lost in July when players like LeBron and Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard decide where they want to spend their primes. And I think that's interesting. But in a world where they're deciding to spend it in big cities, those four markets, that means something really different for the markets that aren't in that list. And that's why I think the draft becomes extremely important there. And I think that quote does sum it up.
So the draft pick thing has tons of implications that I think are really interesting. Number one, so you have all these teams that are simultaneously coming to this realization and have like three teams own half the picks in the NBA universe right now. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but between New Orleans, Oklahoma City, et cetera, Houston is now starting to pile up picks and will start to pile up even more picks. And you just wonder, is there a zero-sum game there? Like, can four teams building that way at the same time all win? Or will one of them inevitably sort of lose out because there's only so many successful picks to go around? I'm not sure. They have so many picks, maybe it doesn't matter. The flip side of that is that the teams that are acquiring the superstars, they have their windows are very, very short. Because when you're all in for dudes who are 30 to 32 years old, you've got to win within 3 years. And then the aging is against you and you don't have picks. Or the picks you have are bad because you're too good to what in the years that you have picks, if you even control them, if you haven't swapped them out, you pick low in the draft and there's no way to replenish your team. So you either continue to make these sort of like, you know, not desperate, but win now cash grabs, or you have to reset it without a lot of ways to reset it. And your window for that particular team to get to know each other, to develop chemistry, to win is very, very short. And so there's on both sides of this are interesting implications. And hovering over all of that, and I wonder if this is why so many of these teams are just saying, give me all the picks, as many picks as you can, is that the league changed the lottery odds to make it much harder for you to sort of game the system. Like if you have the worst record in the NBA, you used to have a great shot at getting the number one pick and 0% chance at falling below whatever it was, number four. Now you can have the worst record in the NBA and pick fifth. We've seen teams come in with the second best lottery odds and pick sixth or seventh. That has warped the landscape almost completely in ways that I think teams are still kind of reckoning with.
Yeah, I think so. I think tanking was a major strategy for a team that was sort of in the in-between zone. And I think the new lottery odds have rewired the odds so much that people are still kind of recalibrating what the best move is. It used to be the obvious best move. Now I'm not so sure that it is, but I think, you know what, the draft is now the main vehicle for these small market teams, no matter what, no matter the lottery odds. And player development is emerging in these small market teams as sort of the secret second way to improve your team. And one thing that always separates the great small market teams from the struggling ones is like, hey, did that second round pick turn out? Did that 26th pick turn out? And you know, San Antonio obviously has done a great job with those picks, but so is Toronto. Indiana seems to be doing a good job. Oklahoma City does a good job in that department. And you see players like Lu Dort or Pascal Siakam really come into their own because of the, their own talent, obviously, but because the market is able to take that draft pick and make those help those people become the best basketball versions of themselves. And I think that player development apparatus is another sign of this movement and how important it is in a small market. If you want to be a good small market team, you better have elite player development on your side.
And there are a couple of flip sides. Like I mentioned the Jimmy Butler example, and you can go through, you know, I wrote a whole piece on sort of the prison of the max contract. It's the piece that you're, that you're citing. And how the Bulls voluntarily getting off of Jimmy Butler just set alarm bells off in my head at when it happened. And the Clippers, having it be a win for the Clippers to get off Blake Griffin as soon as they did. Franchise player drafted number one, franchise icon. Having it be a 100% certainty that John Wall's contract and Russell Westbrook's contract were going to be bad contracts. Now, the Thunder, God only knows how they did it. They wriggled out of the Russ thing with not only minimal pain, but like actual value. It just made me uncomfortable. And we're going to see this with other players. Like, you know, just as an example, should the Magic pay Nikola Vucevic the max when he comes around or something close to it? You know, people grumbled about the Gobert contract. Like, is he worth the Supermax? Oh my God, that's going to be disastrous. I just, part of this is on the other side. It just makes me uncomfortable that it like becomes bad. It's bad. It becomes bad for teams to retain their own players, so much so that some teams have decided we don't want to retain this player that is a massive organizational success story for us. We would rather trade him for a poo-poo platter of young players and picks, even in the prime of his career. And I proposed a bunch of ideas. People can go back and read them about maybe remedies to make it not so crippling to your cap sheet or whatever. If you draft a player, retain him, and then retain him again, are there tax benefits? Are there CBA benefits? Are there ways to make it so it's not just teams are like, oh my God, do I really need to pay this price for this guy? That there are many sides to this, and that's another one that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. But you know, when you see big market teams acquiring players or players chasing big markets and going there, you also see teams voluntarily getting off really good players in ways that I think just puts those players back into the ecosystem to go wherever they want.
Yeah, and it's been hard to watch. Like, really great players from a decade become sort of toxic, not because of their play, but because of their contract. And some of these designated player contracts, the Supermax contracts, have gone to players that just aren't quite good enough to really get that number. But in some cases, the incumbent team had no choice but to give them that number. And then they're set up for failure, or the contract itself becomes an albatross. I think one thing is that club is a little too big potentially for that Supermax category. You see some players, and I'm not going to name names, that probably shouldn't be in that category. And then I would say there is an obvious category of guys, including LeBron and Durant and Steph and Lillard, who are obviously deserving of that. And one thing that came out when I was doing the research for this piece, Zach, is those dudes are arguably the most underpaid players in pro sports right now. LeBron James is arguably the most underpaid player in pro sports right now. If you look at contracts around the world, for instance, Messi's contract in Barcelona, LeBron James getting 35% of the cap. Hey, anybody would trade paychecks with LeBron James that I know. But that said, he might deserve more than that. And that artificial constraining of his salary might enable teams like the Lakers to pair two or three of these guys on one cap sheet. If LeBron James were to make 50% of the cap, 55% of the cap, and I'm not advocating that per se, but indulge me for a second, Zach. If he were, the Lakers would have a real hard time building a team around him and Anthony Davis. They might still be able to do it. But I think that's another point here, is there are people in this Supermax category that end up with albatross contracts that really just handcuff the team that signed them. And then there are some guys that these are the best bargains in the league. And that's a really interesting situation to me. Like, well, you know what I mean? Like, I don't have a good answer, but that, I think the devil's in the details. And one last thing. Maybe there's a category above the Supermax for the Finals MVP guys, for those first-team All-NBA guys, the perennial guys, a mega max deal. where you have to really be a special, special, special guy to get to that big, big number. And that could change this dynamic a little bit league-wide.
Well, I can tell you for sure, speaking of the Supermax and Supermax-worthy guys, there are a lot of high fives, and well, there are no high fives anymore, but there would have been a lot of high fives in the league office when the news broke that Giannis re-signing with the Bucks. And the next big test case is going to be Jokic, who I can't remember exactly when he becomes eligible. I think this is somehow only his sixth season, so he's a bit to go before he becomes eligible for a Supermax. Now, I don't know Nikola well, but everything I've heard and everything I've talked to, I don't think he gives one flying F-U-C-K about the glitz and glamour of anywhere. And if he's happy in Denver, he's going to be happy in Denver. But that will be the next test case. And by the way, I don't know, you know, the player empowerment thing is so interesting because I largely am fine with it, as I said before. I also think teams are living in fear of sort of how far will it go. So one of the scenarios that you hear about is who's going to be the first superstar coming off his rookie deal, the first real superstar who says, you know what, I'm just going to take the qualifying offer. I'm not even going to negotiate a contract with you guys. If I'm the number one pick, my qualifying offer for 1 year, and then I become an unrestricted free agent. I'm not even going to deal with restricted free agents. I want it out of here as soon as possible. And some of the qualifying offers for the top picks are like $15 million. It used to be like four. Now it's a huge amount of money. Now it's less than they would make if they signed a new contract right then and there. But if you really want out, the dollars are getting to the point that in the next 10 years, someone is going to at least investigate, should I do that? Someone who's, and it's not going to be a case of, well, our negotiations are going badly, so I'm going to play that carrot. It's going to be someone who really wants out. And then, you know, I asked Michelle Roberts when I wrote this piece about player empowerment, would the union ever push to get rid of restricted free agency altogether? Now, I don't think that's a battle they can win, but here's what she told me. We have always strove to loosen the restrictions in free agency. We will do that again in the next CBA negotiations. Now, I don't think they're going to get that because that might be a blood issue for teams and the trade-off for them would be so. But that gets you thinking about, well, what's the end game of player empowerment? And I think we saw some of it with James Harden in Houston. And the end game is going to be, I am going to raise enough of a stink and my effort level will be dialed back at times to the point of, I'm just going to make this a mess for you until you trade me. And the league is definitely fearful of scenarios where, again, I've given this example before, a player just says, hey, you know what, my back hurts. Like, I think I have a back injury. Like, I need to sit for a little while. And, like, is that kosher? Is that not kosher? But the end, we haven't hit the end game of the – again, there's the team side of this with teams making dumb decisions or the CBA incentivizing teams to make bad decisions with players. There's also this side where I don't think we've seen the end game of either of those.
I just don't know where this ends. I do think that qualifying offer thing is fascinating. And without naming names, there are a couple of very young, bright stars in this league that are currently in not very prestigious markets that I could actually see doing that. And man, that would be a shockwave, wouldn't it? Because I don't think anybody has done it. I think, to your point, the association, the Players Association, should do everything for the players to make free agency easier. I know if I was in the NBA, I'd want to play where I wanted to play and make as much money as I could. Of course, the Players Association is going to try to loosen free agency rules. That's what they should be doing. But is it good for the NBA if somebody like LaMelo Ball or Ja Morant or Zion Williamson is like, you know what, deuces, I'll take the qualifying money. I just want out of here as fast as possible. I want to go to one of these big, fun markets in these great big cities on either coast of the United States.
And the upshot of that, and I don't think any of those players are going to do that, but the upshot of that is then you get into the, you know, the Pelicans were really vilified for, well, they tried to speed up the timetable around Anthony Davis too much. There was too much too soon. They sacrificed too many future draft picks to chase short-term wins with Tyreek Evans and Drew Holiday and on and on and on. Ryan Anderson, you know, they didn't give up much for some of those guys. Some they gave up a lot. Eric Gordon. Well, if that timetable is hanging over your head, you have to excel. You have to try to win around player X immediately after you draft him. So it does have all kinds of implications. You mentioned Harden. I wonder where you would – the end game of this trend that you're pointing out and how it's become baked into the landscape of sports. The apex of it would be if James Harden, in a year where he flouted COVID regulations quite publicly and played his way out of Houston, alienated his teammates, forced a trade after 8 games in Houston where the Rockets were obliterated when he was on the court, won the MVP. And now, as much as you might want to poo-poo that, Joel Embiid, get well, big fella. Joel Embiid, my slight MVP favorite at the halfway point, got hurt on Friday night. He's going to be out a couple of weeks, it seems like. I've heard 2 weeks. I've heard 3 weeks. I've heard 10 games. I've heard seven. Who knows? It's going to be some period of time. And in a shortened season, that's going to be enough, maybe not to eliminate him from the MVP race, actually, but certainly to throw a monkey wrench into his case. And so you can see the scenario. Well, what if the Lakers kind of continue to slump? What if what if Denver doesn't get above fifth in the West? What if every voter is just uncomfortable with the idea of making Giannis the fourth person ever to win 3 MVPs in a row despite flaming out in the playoffs last year? And as I wrote last week, the previous three, Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, and Larry Bird, the only MVP three-peaters ever. Michael Jordan never did it. Kareem never did it. Magic never did it. All three of those players, Wilt, Larry, Russell, won titles, or a title in Wilt's case, midway through that 3 MVP run. Mm-hmm. So none of them went into year 3 having not won a title before. Giannis is obviously in that scenario. So what if all the voters like, I feel queasy about that. And they're looking around. Oh, Brooklyn. Brooklyn's really good. Harden's unbelievable. KD's out for now a long time. No one knows when the hell KD is coming back anymore. It keeps getting extended and extended. What do you think of James Harden's MVP case? Because Embiid's injury has cracked the door open just a little bit.
I don't know about you, Zach, but I think it's weird that the player that we've all agreed is the best player for the last 15 years hasn't won the MVP in 8 years. I heard it said on social media in the last week. I believe it was you who was aggregated all over my social media feed. So LeBron James is now listed by ESPN's official book, the William Hill Sports Book, as...
Is that our official book? I didn't know that. Yes, we have an official book?
Happening. I did not get paid for that, but if anybody wants to send a check my way, just get in touch. But LeBron James, a big free agent migration, by the way, obviously is the favorite. Jokic is up there, Embiid, but Harden, to your point, creeping up there. And in a world where it looks like the Nets are starting to get
You sounded like a movie preview. In a world where the Nets are surging.
In a world where...
In a world where centers are tumbling to the floor.
That would be the action movie I would make, and nobody would watch it. But anyway, James Harden has a legit case if present trends continue. And by that, I mean Joel Embiid on the shelf, LeBron James and the Lakers continuing to kind of struggle, Jokic not getting the Nuggets to the top of the ladder, Steph Curry and the Warriors really struggling, particularly on offense. There is a James Harden case by default if the Nets are going to win 60, 70, 80% of their games, and especially if Kevin Durant is on the shelf. Yeah, James Harden could be traded and win the MVP in the same year. I don't think that's probably ever happened.
It has never happened. It has never happened in season. Now, I will say there have been a bunch of guys who won or got close to winning in their first season with the team after an off-season move. And really, when you think about it, all that distinguishes James Harden being traded to the Nets after 8 games versus Steve Nash, Charles Barkley moving to the Suns via trade and free agency in the offseason is like a month, couple months, right? Yeah. It seems different, but it's not that different. However, as the PR people say, the optics of that extra month for James Harden were, I think, unseemly. I think that's a fair summation of it. And there will be other candidates, by the way. We have to see. Will Luka Doncic play himself into the race? Can Damian Lillard play the Blazers up the standings? Jimmy Butler is getting a little sneaky buzz now.
The Heat are good, man. The Heat are
well,
back
it turns
on my
out
radar.
When you have your play, actually, they don't even have Bam. Their schedule's been a little easy, but this was already shaping up to be just from a pure entertainment standpoint, the best MVP race in 4 years and one of the best ever, because you do have Look, I voted in every single one of those MVPs that LeBron didn't win, and I didn't vote for LeBron once, and I don't regret any of those votes, because if you go year by year by year, there I did. I made the case for other people, and I'm fine with it. Like, in each individual year, it felt fine. I think Giannis is having an unbelievable year, and yet I don't think it's completely unreasonable to feel a little squeamish about, should he get an MVP again after losing 4-1 in the second round of the playoffs? And that contrasts beautifully with the LeBron sort of lifetime achievement sentiment that's going to be out there. I don't know what the hell is going to happen, but every event that occurs seems to be the basketball gods are conspiring to shove James Harden into this conversation. By the way, James Harden has been nothing short of majestic as a Brooklyn Net. Triple-double here, triple-double there. Incredible passing, incredible scoring. As a player for the Nets, he should absolutely be in the MVP conversation. The problem is he was a player for the Rockets for 12% of the season, and although a productive one, not a particularly helpful one. I think it's going to be – could you vote for him? Do you have a vote?
No, I don't have a vote, and I don't want to vote, but that's a story for another time. Listen to this, though. You know, my friends in Houston down the road from Austin, you know, they had a great night last night at the Grammys, and I'm as happy for Beyonce and Megan. But here's the thing.
Well, you're going to have to catch me up on what happened at the Grammys. Just walk it back for me.
Beyonce set the record for most Grammys ever, I think, by a female artist, if not an artist overall. Megan Thee Stallion, I think, had a great night. But they referenced Houston in the rodeo, and our old friend Shea Serrano had a classic tweet about it. But the bottom line here, Zach, is that James Harden does have a legitimate path to the MVP. I think I'd still take LeBron or Embiid at this point. But like you're saying, the basketball gods seem to be trending towards a way for Harden to get there. And I think one of the sneaky reasons he looks so good all of a sudden is his former team, Houston, is in shambles. And they're on this epic losing streak. And I think that's a dark sort of case for him. But Brooklyn looks very, very good without Kevin Durant. And a lot of that is because of James Harden.
Well, and Houston has a big decision to make at the trade deadline with Victor Oladipo, who reportedly turned down a 2-year extension worth whatever was the most they could offer him after the trade. I do wonder if that's one of those cases where it's like, we're going to offer you this. We know you're not going to take it. We now have gone through all the loops. Both of us have it look nice publicly. We both have good reason to do this. And I found it curious at the time that Houston wanted Oladipo and not Caris LeVert in the Harden deal. And I don't know that this, does it look worse now? Maybe, but it also could just be an indication of they want total clear cap sheet going forward, and they're okay with Oladipo even walking. And if so, they should attempt to move him now. But that's a big name. I'm just not sure if I'm some of the teams that have been rumored. I know the teams that have been linked to him. I wrote this about the Knicks before the season. They were taking we got to wait and see with Victor after the injury and the very short season last season. I'm not sure anything they've waited and seen would convince me that I need to go get Victor Oladipo right now for the stretch run. So I'm not sure where Houston is going to find a deal there, but my guess is that they will look. That's one of the more obvious names, right?
You know, I think Victor Oladipo is one of the more intriguing rentals on the market. I think any team that's sort of on the edge, that's struggling with perimeter offense, can look at Victor and say, man, it's worth a short-term rental here. And the question is, what kind of price is Houston going to ask? There's some intel out there, Zach, that I'm sure you've heard, that Houston is asking for a lot for some of their players. PJ Tucker comes to mind as well. An interesting thing about Tucker, by the way, he doesn't look as great when James Harden's not out there firing him all those threes. But point made, I think there's a really intriguing market for Oladipo, whether it's somebody like Miami or Denver, the Clippers. Somebody's going to talk themselves into, man, this is the exact kind of guy we need to elevate our chances in the stretch run.
I'm a little skeptical, but we'll see. And Tucker, I do think Tucker, he's shooting like 31% from three. He looks a little slow-footed even by his standards. I do think that if he landed on a contender, we would see a reinvigorated PJ Tucker who makes maybe, I don't know how many more shots he'll make, because I still think he was getting decent looks even without Harden. But I do think it'll be a sort of a Nick Batum. you want to go through a couple of the other interesting teams as we get up to the trade deadline? So let's start with one that I'm not sure they're interesting, but they're interesting to me, and it touches on the point that we talked about, talking about your piece, and that's your old team, the Spurs. You don't have to talk about the Spurs. I can talk about the Spurs if you want. But I look at them. I'm super fascinated by what they do at the fork in the road that they are now reaching. So they've got, well, LaMarcus we'll talk about. They've got DeRozan, Mills, Gay, all these veterans. And I think all those veterans, I'm not sure they're available, but the Spurs are definitely listening. And if you offer them something real, I think you could potentially get any of those guys. More interesting to me, though, is what's next for the Spurs? Like, say DeRozan is gone, Aldridge is gone, all the vets are gone. You've got DeJounte Murray, Lonnie Walker IV, Keldon Johnson, Jakob Poeltl, Vassell, the kid they just drafted. I'm including Luka Samanić now. Croatia's own Luka Samanić is getting in the young core. And like all those players, DeJounte Murray, I forgot, I think. All those players are good. And for where they were drafted are mostly really, really good draft picks. I look at it as, okay, so what is that core? What is that core getting me going forward? And the answer is, of course, I don't know. One of the things I've learned covering the NBA is that young players, if they put in the work and they have good coaching, some of them, lots of them, are going to outpace the development curve you envision for them when they're 20 and 21 years old. And there is a world in which that core of players grows together into a damn good team. It may be a 50-win team, maybe even something better. There are also more worlds. If you simulated this for 1,000 times, I think most of them will be, they grow into a pretty good team. Without a star, without maybe without a guy who makes any all-star teams, maybe without a guy who makes more than one or two, and just becomes like Pacers West. And if that's the case, if you are running the Spurs and that's what you see, now this is the most conservative organization in sports. They haven't made an in-season trade in 1,000 years. They don't make outgoing calls, all the stuff you hear about them. If that's the case, if you think that's your future, shouldn't you just see what you can get if you package a lot of these guys in picks? Like, in theory, the Spurs make a very intriguing Bradley Beal fit, but just to get the first guy in the door to help get you a second guy, and obviously to even get in that conversation, you'd have to gauge to see if you have any interest in re-signing there. If not, then no, we're not doing any of this. But in theory, the Spurs are an interesting candidate holding all their picks. They have a gazillion in cap space coming up to sniff around packaging stuff for a big name. But this gets at the point, exact point your story is about, which is, can they do that in San Antonio, or are all their picks and young players so much more valuable to them? I forgot about Derek White too, right? Who's not so young, but he's very good. Like that you sort of are naturally pointed toward stasis. And by the way, stasis might be good. All of those players are good. Now you're going to have to pay all of them. All of a sudden they're going to be making $100 million combined before you blink. But From the perspective of that market, it's hard to talk yourself into, let's be aggressive, let's make all these kind of trades that the big teams are making.
Yeah, and I just don't know, going back to the nature of that story, if a market like San Antonio is a legitimate place to sort of enter that blockbuster trade sweepstakes, because there's no confidence that you're going to be able to extend the superstar you're able to bring back with all this talent. And I do think the San Antonio Spurs have done a fantastic job of drafting between 20 and 30 over the last 5 years and turning out a new young core that puts them in a position to build a team in a couple of ways. If I had to say, you know, those are my friends there, they're going to try to do this with consistency and with loyalty and watching these guys develop and take pride in that process and not skip steps. I don't think they're going to look to move a lot of those young guys. I think the vets is interesting. And you pointed out that they haven't made a lot of in-season trades, which is an exaggeration. They haven't made any. But I do think this year's a little different. I think they're taking calls. And I think if they got something real, as you said, you know, they might part ways with some of these guys, because some of those guys might want to part ways too. They want to go to the playoffs or they want to compete. And they might get the right offer from the right team. So I do think they're at a big point. If I had to guess, they're going to try to grow their own food from scratch and prove to the basketball world that you can still do this with the draft and with player development. And yeah, in 4 years, we look up and they're back at the 3 seed or the 5 seed in the West. And I think they would be happy with that. And they haven't compromised their values. They're a values-driven organization. So I don't see them in the Bradley Beal marketplace. I see them more as a – yeah, let's grow this core up together and see where it takes us.
Have you found any good LaMarcus Aldridge trades? Because I truthfully have not been able to.
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure what LaMarcus's value is. I mean, there's a couple teams out there who you look at their front court and you're like, man, they could be better with LaMarcus Aldridge in a rotational role. And you know, whether that's Boston or Toronto or whatever, I'll leave that up to others. I mean, I haven't seen one yet that is great, but that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. I like to remind people, like, the Kawhi trade came out of relative nowhere. You know, J.A. Adande, I believe, says real trades travel in silence. So I'm not one to listen to the internet and find a legitimate trade and be like, oh, that's probably going to happen.
Let's talk about another team, the Toronto Raptors. And we talked about this on the pod before the All-Star break, when the COVID stuff just smashed them all at once, and they still have not had Siakam, Anunoby, or Van Vliet back, and they have lost, I believe, 5 in a row, and they are down to 11th in the East at 17-22. My friend Michael Grange wrote a piece last week basically warning everyone Kyle Lowry is extremely unlikely to be traded at the trade deadline. And Grange is awesome, and he's super plugged in Toronto. I don't think the door has been shut on that. Let me put it that way. I don't, and he didn't say that it had been shut on that. He actually hedged and said it could still be open. I think it's cracked open just because, again, this team is now 5 games under 500. Now, when they get back, will they be much better than that? Absolutely. They still have a positive scoring margin. I still think that door is ajar. I think it might take me more hands than I have to count how many teams have inquired about Norm Powell with them, who has a player option for next season that he probably should decline and is playing out of his mind.
Yes, he is.
And you want to hear that and say, well, isn't that tantamount to tanking if the Raptors sort of bail out of those guys? And I would say no. I would say it's tantamount to, and by the way, I have no idea what the Raptors are going to do. Let me be clear. But if they did that, I would say it's tantamount to saying, this season with no fans, it hasn't gone to expectations. We're not where we thought we'd be in the standings. We can sacrifice this season or just punt it a little bit. And we still have Fred VanVleet, OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, Malachi Flynn, a bunch of other, all of our picks and everything. No, we're not tanking. Like, that's a pretty good foundation of players. Maybe we'll get one more high draft pick this year to augment that. But we'll come back right next year and we'll be a pretty good team, not a great team, just a nice team, but that's not tanking. And what it really is if you've decided as an organization that, you know, Kyle Lowry wants to, if you've decided Kyle Lowry wants to finish his career somewhere else, or it's not, doesn't make sense for us to pay Kyle Lowry's next contract, it makes all the sense in the world that you would explore up until March 25th if everyone involved has given it the right blessing, what you could get for Kyle Lowry. So I just don't think the door has been totally closed on that. That's my Toronto Raptors take.
You know, I'm with you. And I think there, Kyle Lowry might be the best player available if, in fact, he is available. You know, at this stage of the season, very rarely does a championship-winning point guard become available on the trade market. And if he is, like, you're going to see a team talk themselves into paying a lot for him. And maybe there's discussions behind closed doors one way or the other. I want to finish as a Raptor. No, I want to go try to win right now. I don't know. But those are really influential discussions too. And I think from Kyle all the way through the coaching staff and into Masai Ujiri's office, you know, there's different kinds of conversations happening. Obviously from the front office perspective, from the long-term growth horizon of the organization, if somebody wants to pay you a lot of money or players and assets and draft picks for Kyle Lowry right now at this phase of his career, that's a pretty enticing option. So I think they would consider it there, but also Kyle has become one of these just, God, can you picture him in another uniform? And now we've seen him in other uniforms, but he does seem like Mr. Raptor. He does seem like a guy who's going to be around Toronto for years and years after he's done playing. But man, I just don't know, Zach. And the last thing I'd say on Toronto is, like, God, this team has had a tough year. I mean, everybody's had a tough year.
Oh, absolutely brutal.
But it's just brutal. Remember, they're playing in Tampa, Florida. Like, they had to pick up and move their lives, and they're living in a hotel, essentially on a year-long road trip. So, oh, God, I feel for those guys, and I'm not sure what they're thinking, in part because their year has been so tough.
sort of a junior varsity version of the Raptors in that same sense is Orlando, who's at now 13-26. They're 14th in the East. They've lost 8 games in a row. A team that made the playoffs the last 2 years, had playoff ambitions this year. Injuries have absolutely decimated them. I will not even list all the players who are injured. It's too many to name. And they have Evan Fournier on an expiring contract, Terrence Ross, Aaron Gordon, whose name has been all over the rumor mill in perpetuity, and ditto for Nick Vucevic. And, you know, you want to say, well, this team could just sort of let the season play out. They're going to get a high draft pick as things pan out, as things stand now. Get that high draft pick, bring all these dudes back, and be a good team next year. But Fournier is sort of their, again, junior varsity Lowry, in that if he is expiring, if you don't want to pay him, it behooves you to explore the trade market for him. Gordon is the more interesting one because, you know, we've all ad nauseum talked about he's a four. He needs to play the four. The Magic try to shoehorn him into playing the three. Jonathan Isaac is coming. Chuma Okeke is pretty good. They have Aminu still, who's probably untradeable or borderline untradeable. Does he really fit there? And teams, there are lots of teams. Minnesota's been mentioned a lot, and I think that's accurate, that have made a lot of calls about Aaron Gordon. I don't know what they're going to do, but they could just, it's that same issue of like, how many guys can we keep and still be bad this year and come back and be good with the high draft pick next year? If I had to get, and if I had to guess, this is my guess, I would guess, and you made me guess on every guy, I would guess trade Fournier, keep Ross, keep Vucevic, just because I think they're going to demand like a Drew Holiday level haul for Vucevic if anyone calls to try to get him. He's been so good for them. Just outstanding. And Gordon, whew, I don't even know what I would. I guess I would go 51% trade, 49% keep.
I don't have a good feel for Gordon in the market for Gordon. He's an enigmatic player. Like analytically, I just don't know if I'm buying into him. I'm sure different teams have different opinions. I've heard the same things about Minnesota being very interested in Aaron Gordon. And, you know, when you watch him in the dunk contest, he could talk yourself into Aaron Gordon real fast. But, you know, is this a guy who you can build around? I'm not so sure that everybody agrees there. And one interesting thing when I think about it, both Orlando and Houston right now, is that the play-in mania, and I love play-in mania, Zach. By the way, play-in mania, I'm getting ready for play-in mania.
I think the play-in's going to be a huge hit. I mean, it was a huge hit last year, but it was kind of like trial phase, bubble situation. I think this is going to be the real play-in now, the 7-10-8-9 thing. I think it's going to be a huge hit.
Me too. And I think there's going to be 6 single elimination NBA games, and there's going to be big stars in them, and that's going to be awesome. But one of the other very interesting byproducts, I think, of the play-in era in the NBA, Zach, is it's really shrunk the overall size of the seller's market. There's only a few teams that are really out of it at this point. And that's because we go all the way to the 10 seed to get into that play-in environment. So there's really 5 teams on either side that aren't going to be playing for playoff slots. Orlando and Houston are among those teams that are kind of out of it and kind of have a lot of tradable pieces right now. And in a weird way, I didn't foresee this coming. The trade market is really beneficial to these teams in ways that it hasn't been in years past. And Orlando, as you really well outlined, has a lot of great tradable contracts. I have a feeling somebody's going to talk themselves into Fournier, and I think you said that. I think he's the most likely piece for a team that needs a guard that could score the ball. He's a really tempting piece. Aaron Gordon as well, I think, is a superstar in some people's eyes. And I think, you know, Orlando has a lot of opportunities to build their asset base through this trade deadline coming up.
The last one I want to talk about is Minnesota, because I expect them to be very, very active. But it's be interesting because you mentioned the dearth of sellers. They should be an obvious one because they're 9-30 and completely out of it and should be orienting everything toward the future. But I just don't know what they have to sell, really. And so I wonder if they will be active on all fronts, trying to see, is there a player we can acquire that would help us now or help us now and next year going forward? And at the same time, making calls like, what can we get for player X? Like, I think if I were a GM that really loved Jarrett Culver, I would be calling Minnesota to try and see if I can get Jarrett Culver. I don't know that such a GM exists. Jarrett Culver has been injured and out of the rotation for the Wolves a lot this year. But I do think the Wolves look like a disaster.
Yeah.
And in a lot of ways, they are a disaster. But I do think it's important to note D'Angelo Russell's out. Malik Beasley is currently suspended. Russell, Beasley, and Towns have barely played at all together. Like, there's a universe in which these guys get healthy and look like a competitive, normal NBA rebuilding team for the last 10 or 15 games of the season. But, you know, you look at the optics of LaMelo Ball's out playing Anthony Edwards, although Anthony Edwards is surging lately, so maybe that's not so bad. Culver's really on the fringes. You owe this pick to the Warriors, which is a top three protected pick this year, unprotected next year. It doesn't look great right now, and I would expect them to be, you know, maybe they don't end up doing anything, but I would expect them to be among the most active teams sort of investigating every kind of deal, whatever sort of they can find that benefits them.
Yeah, they're a really interesting team. I think, frankly, it's very disappointing when you look at their draft history and where they've been able to pull and who they've been able to pull out of these drafts. And the fact that they're sitting here at 9-30, and as you know, their statistical markers are terrible. Sure, they've had players that miss time. Which team this year hasn't? You know, almost everybody's missing time to some degree. I think undeniably Minnesota's had a disappointing season. I love Anthony Edwards. I mean, the eye-popping stats from three-point range the other night. If he's able to shoot, obviously the dunks, everybody's seen the dunks. Is he the piece you build around now? Is Karl Anthony Towns still the piece we're building around? I don't even know what their identity is going forward. But yeah, they have a team. They have an opportunity too. This season's a loss in Minnesota. This season is over in Minnesota. I think the most prudent thing to do is determine who you want to build around and what kind of team you want to build, and use this trade deadline, Zach, to turn a couple of your current players into future assets or other players that you like for next season or the following season.
I just don't know. Like, you can call me about Jake Lehman and Josh Okogie, and my response is going to be, these guys are not in your rotation and you're the worst team in the NBA, or they're sometimes not in your rotation and you're the worst team. Like, why am I giving you anything for these players if your own coaching staff has determined that they can't even play for your team, or they can only sometimes play for your team? And I'm not giving up Jaden McDaniels. I know teams have asked Minnesota about him, and I'll leave it at that. I would hold on to him. I think he's an interesting prospect. Well, 10 days away, Mr. Goldsberry. We're almost there. Everyone should check out your piece. It's on ESPN.com. It's been leading the NBA page for most of today, Monday. The Coastal Elite Status of NBA Superstars and Super Teams. Mr. Goldsberry, it's always good to see you. I have your map, your Naismith Memorial Basketball Park map. It's in a frame.
No, it's not in a tube. Most of the people I hear, they're still in a tube. I'm glad you got a frame.
No, it's framed, and it's now waiting for someone, maybe me, I don't know, to hang it on a wall. But thank you for all your work, sir. Best to your family.
Hey, thanks.
Our Difference Maker of the Week is brought to you by our friends at CarMax. Thank you, CarMax. Don't just buy a car, love your car with the new CarMax Love Your Car Guarantee. This week's Difference Maker is, you know what? I'm going to give it to the NBA and the brains who have helped reinvent All-Star Weekend. The NBA gets made fun of all the times for gimmicky innovations, fixing problems that don't exist, getting too creative with the traditions of the game. Let's give them some credit for really repairing All-Star Weekend. Picking teams has been a home run. How funny was it to see the Jazz snubbed with the last two picks and LeBron saying, no slander against Utah, and then here I'm going to slander Utah. It pits teammates against each other. It was really cool to see Jason Tatum slap the floor and get into a defensive stance against Jaylen Brown. Obviously, both of them play for the Celtics. The three-point shootout is better with the full money ball rack and with those long-distance Mountain Dew shots. I mean, that's where guys are shooting from these days. Let's make it happen. I think they should add a half-court shot. The Elam ending without a clock to end the All-Star game, it wasn't that exciting this year, but we got a Damian Lillard almost half-court shot to end the game. Home run idea. I love it. They have really fixed All-Star Weekend. It's much better now than it was before. That's our Difference Maker of the Week. Again, our thanks to CarMax. For more Difference Makers, check out my weekly 10 Things column on the ESPN Insider page.